listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrad. Last month saw the anniversary of the Roe versus Wade decision at the U.S. Supreme Court. The anniversary day also saw a continuing political and legal battle as Republicans in the U.S. House passed a law aimed at making sure federal money couldn't be used to pay for abortions.
That federal action comes as many states have issued restrictions on abortions, including Wisconsin's recent law requiring providers to have admitting rights at hospitals, which is currently not in effect after being struck down in a federal court.
Our next guest says many of those efforts are misguided. In a new book, he traces the impact of legal abortion since that Supreme Court ruling. He says we tend to forget the damage done by illegal abortion and to overlook what he says are the benefits of legalization. Dr. David Grimes is former chief of the Abortion Surveillance Branch at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He's the author of the book, Every Third Woman in America, How Legal Abortion Transformed Our Nation. Dr. Grimes, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
So I wanted to start with a before and after picture. You've written that you're worried that people, including other doctors, have forgotten what things were like before Roe versus Wade. Can you paint us a picture?
I think it's a very clear analogy to what's happening now with measles. An entire generation of Americans has grown up unaware of the danger of measles, and we see people getting complacent about going back to the bad old days. We're now seeing a resurgence of that. Same thing true for abortion. We've had an entire generation of Americans unaware of the dangers of illegal abortion, and we simply cannot go back to those bad old days when women suffered and died in large numbers.
How big of a health impact was this? How much of a stress did this put on the healthcare system?
Well, abortion has been with us as long as pregnancy has been with us. And estimates from the days between, or I should say before Roe v. Wade, were that somewhere between 200,000 and 1.2 million illegal and unsafe abortions took place each year in the United States. And that caused terrible suffering and deaths. For example, every large municipal hospital in America had an entire ward filled with patients suffering from infectious complications. And in the year that I was born, more than 700 women died this way. And the population of the nation was less than half of that today. So that would be the equivalent of over 1,000 women dying every year from unsafe abortion today.
So now let's look at the after picture. What impact has legalized abortion had since Roe versus Wade?
Well, deaths from illegal abortion disappeared almost overnight. Abortion has become one of the safest procedures in all of medicine. Indeed, for the last several decades, the risk of death from an abortion is less than that from an injection of penicillin.
So I want to turn to the title of your book, Every Third Woman. That's how many women in the United States have had an abortion at some point in their lives?
That's correct. A little known fact, but if current rates prevailed, one out of every three American women will have had one or more abortions by the time she reaches menopause. Since Roe v. Wade, more than 50 million American women and their families have been beneficiaries of safe legal abortion.
And I wanted to talk some more about the benefits for women. That's part of what you look at in your book. What are the benefits outside of health, but the social benefits, as you see it, for women having access to abortions?
Well, safe legal abortion rivals modern contraception, such as the birth control pill, in enabling women to space pregnancies. This allows them to continue to higher education, to join the labor force, and to contribute to American society in many, many important ways other than just bearing children.
And you follow up on that by looking at the impact on families as well.
Right. The legalization of abortion quickly had an impact in preventing shotgun marriages. It prevented or lowered the risk of having single women heading family households. It also led to drops in premature births and neonatal or early newborn deaths. So it had a number of obvious and important health benefits very, very quickly.
Now, you've talked and written, not just in your book, about almost a linguistic war over definitions in the abortion debate, swapping around words like fetus, preborn, things like that. Can you untangle that a little for us?
Right. There's certainly a terminological tangle surrounding abortion. Some of this is due to naivete. Some of it's due to disinformation and misinformation. The misuse is intentional. We hear terms like the unborn child. Well, if you look at any dictionary, children don't live in the uterus. There are many places they can live, but that's not the uterus. The occupant of the uterus is an embryo and then later a fetus. That's not the same as a child. And just like a fetus is not a preborn, I'm not a postborn, and I'm also not a pre-dead person. So we ought to be careful about terms. Words matter, and we should use them wisely.
But regardless of the scientific definitions of the words, a lot of people, based on their moral and ethical system, believe that the embryo or a fetus is the moral equivalent of a human life. So logically, they would object to any form of abortion.
Well, these same people would have us believe that blueprints for a house are the same thing as a complete structure, and burning the blueprints would be essentially equivalent to arson. Most reasonable people say that's simply not the case.
Well, obviously, a lot of people feel that way, though. That's why these state laws, and we'll get into those in a minute, why these state laws are emerging. That's why it's a national issue. A lot of people's philosophical and moral system leads them to that decision. How you want to change that, it sounds like. How do you reach out to them and convince them to think otherwise?
Well, I wouldn't want to. I'm certainly not trying to change other people's thinking, but by the same token, how should or why should they be able to change my thinking and my practice and taking care of my patients? It's a matter of choice, and they should not force their opinions on me and my patients, especially when the health benefits of my course of action are so clear and incontrovertible. I'm not trying to change opinions, but they're trying to change mine. That's the problem. And they stand between me and my patients, and that violates my ethical principles as a doctor.
Well, I want to get into the state laws that I just mentioned. A lot of different states, including Wisconsin, have had some efforts to get some or all of these that we'll get into. I want to start with the idea of waiting periods, the idea that often a woman seeking abortion has to have one appointment, have a certain amount of time, a cool down period, some call it, and then come down and have the procedure. What do you see is wrong with that?
Well, first of all, it's degrading. Degrading to women, suggesting that they're flighty and capricious and haven't really thought about their course of action. By the time a woman gets to a provider, she's already thought long and hard about her decision. It trivializes women further by suggesting that 24 or 48 hours is going to make a difference. The ultimate goal of these laws, and the anti-abortionists are quite clear on this, is to deter women and make it so expensive and so inconvenient that they simply can't access the services. It also serves to drive women across state lines, increasing the costs and risk to them.
And then another state law we see often is the idea that women have to receive some type of state-mandated counseling, and that usually involves a specific list of things they need to hear before receiving an abortion. What do you make of those?
These are highly offensive, not only to women, but also to us as physicians. It suggests that we physicians are not capable of doing informed consent, as we do for all operations or procedures. And again, more than 50 million times, we doctors have done this quite well. There's actually a survey done of abortion patients by the Picker Institute some years ago in Boston. They followed up several thousand abortion patients to ask them about their care. And the overwhelming consensus was that women felt that the quality and quantity of information they received about abortion was superior. So there's just no evidence that they need more. And the problem with the state-mandated information is it's oftentimes disinformation, not information. And both these crisis pregnancy centers to which women are referred and the internet sources have been shown to be full of propaganda that's unscientific and untrue.
Could you give an example of what you're calling disinformation? What kind of misinformation do you see women receiving under these state mandates?
Common misinformation or disinformation is the allegation that abortion increases the risk of breast cancer, which is a lie, that it leads to mental health problems, which is a lie, which it leads to prematurity, which is another lie. But these things are widely disputed or refuted in the medical literature, yet they're popular among these crisis pregnancy centers, which have a religious theme and not a medical theme as their basis.
While we're on the subject of misinformation, we are, of course, in the age of the internet. Do you think that is leading to better or worse information in the general public when it comes to abortion?
Substantially worse. And there was just a paper out published in December of last year by Dr. Amy Bryant and colleagues at the University of North Carolina looking nationwide at internet sites from these crisis pregnancy centers. And it confirmed what we had suspected, and that is there's gross misinformation and disinformation being dispensed by these sites. As a physician, I can say that I spend a good bit of time in clinic trying to disabuse patients of the fearful and dreadful things they hear or read about on the internet.
One more common state law, and this is one that's passed here in Wisconsin. It's on hold, struck down by a federal court. Supporters are hoping to get it to the U.S. Supreme Court at some point. The idea that an abortion clinic, an abortion provider, needs to have admitting privileges to a nearby, you know, within a certain radius, hospital in case of emergencies.
This is a particularly pernicious kind of legal restriction. First of all, no one supports this in the medical community. The American Medical Association does not. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists does not. The American Academy of Dermatology as well disagrees with this position. It's gratuitous. Secondly, any hospital in the United States which receives federal funds through Medicare or Medicaid must accept emergency patients in transfer for stabilization, regardless of ability to pay. So there are no needs for this. Hospitals will take emergency patients as is by federal law.
So you see this as an effort to restrict, make it harder to have this kind of clinic in place?
Well, what it does, it gives local hospitals veto power and restraint of trade over local clinics.
We're talking to Dr. David Grimes, former chief of the Abortion Surveillance Branch at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and author of the book Every Third Woman, How Legal Abortion Transformed Our Nation.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with what our guest says are the benefits of legal abortion, or are you in favor of more restrictions on abortion providers, maybe even outlawing abortion altogether? Call us at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with Dr. David Grimes. He's the author of Every Third Woman in America, How Legal Abortion Transformed Our Nation. And he makes the case that making abortion legal has had benefits for American women, and he's worried about state and congressional efforts to create new restrictions.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Would you like to see more restrictions on abortion or see it outlawed again? Or do you make the case and agree with the guest that abortion access has benefits for women, for families? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller. We've got Laura on the line in Lake Geneva. Laura, hi.
Hi. I was listening to your show, and it really hit home in a lot of ways. About 40 years ago, I was about 17 or 18, and I became pregnant and thought long and hard about aborting the fetus. And I was young, I was scared, and my partner at the time made arrangements for me to meet with a gentleman. Well, it was actually a physician, but it was done in a hotel room. And, of course, I was terrified. And I had a second one about it. 6 months later, I became pregnant again. And this time I met up with it was a group of women that we were taken in a minivan blindfolded to the place where the procedure was done. And again, I was terrified. I was young. I went on birth control after that, but my gosh, it was a scary experience, I'll tell you. And I made out safely, but it was scary.
Laura, thanks a lot for your call. Not unique stories in the age before Roe versus Wade, Dr. Grimes?
Correct. Laura, I appreciate your sharing that difficult story with us. And those kinds of horrific experiences were very common back then. I'm old enough to remember those bad old days, and we must not return to them. That is the alternative for our nation if these laws increase.
Thanks for sharing your experiences, Laura. We've got Jim on the line next in Marinette. Jim, hi.
Hi. I think arguing that pro-life and pro-choice are the opposite of each other is like saying that apples are the opposite of calculators. They have nothing to do with each other. What you need to do is get, are we pro-abortion or anti-abortion? I think abortion should be legal, but I think we should solve the problem of it, so many people wanting them, like making adoption a much easier choice in the United States, maybe paying for a mother's medical bills, and at the end of the pregnancy, giving her a stipend or something like that to give her child up for adoption, because it seems crazy that adoptions are so expensive in this country that people go to Russia and everywhere else to adopt kids.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. There's often, the argument, okay, let's set the argument aside and find solutions, Dr. Grimes, that make abortion more rare anyway. Do you think that's a productive way of approaching the problem?
Absolutely. I think Jim's point is very well taken. Abortion is not a problem. The problem is an unintended or abnormal pregnancy, and we should work toward reducing that. But words count, though. He said the pro-abortion, anti-abortion. No one is pro-abortion. Just like saying no one is pro-mastectomy. It's not an inherently nice operation, but sometimes a mastectomy is just what a woman needs. We should work to reducing the need for the operation.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jim. David is with us now in Duluth. David, hi.
Hi, doctor. In my home state of Texas, the legislature has enacted a lot of restrictions on the physical facilities that abortion clinics may operate out of. This has caused most of them, as I understand it, to close because they can't afford the changes in the architecture of their buildings. As I understand it, they have to now have very similar facilities as an outpatient surgery clinic. I'd like your comments on this, the necessity of this. What type of problems does this raise for clinics to meet, and what type of problems might it solve?
David, thanks for your call. Dr. Grimes?
Thank you for that very important question. These laws, which are called Targeted Regulation of Abortion Providers, or TRAP laws for short, are widely used around the country to try to drive providers out of business by making it simply too expensive to stay in business. First of all, there is no public health need for them. But as I mentioned before, the risk of abortion is negligible. The risk of death has been less than 1 in 100,000 for many decades. Having a baby in the United States is 14 times more likely to result in death of the woman, yet we see no attention spent on the safety of childbearing in America. What's happening in Texas is that women in West Texas are being driven across the border now into New Mexico. Women in South Texas are crossing into Mexico to get illegal abortions. This is really a sad state of affairs. There have been studies as to what are predictors of states implementing these trap laws, and it has nothing to do with religiosity, the proportion of Catholics in the state, but the one significant predictor is control of both houses of the legislature and the governor's office by a Republican.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Margie in Milwaukee. Margie, hi.
Hi. This hits me emotionally for lots of different reasons. I totally agree with the doctor, and I'm disappointed that it's taken so long for a lot of the medical community to come out and fight against all this craziness that's going on in all these other states where the laws have been changed so that abortions are harder or impossible to get. I was pregnant 40 years ago before marriage, and I fought long and hard, and it was just the year after Roe versus Wade. A girl in my dormitory at college nearly died coming back from an out-of-state abortion, and she was right across the hall from me, and I remember that paramedics coming in to get her and take her to the hospital because of a botched abortion, and they said that she might not ever have children again after that. I got married and had my child, but 17 years later, I went through a divorce, and I had four children, two of which were under 2 years of age. If all these laws and changes come forward so it's impossible for women to get abortions, what happens to a woman that is raped and wants to have an abortion? I was petrified. I would have been petrified because as a mother, single mother of four kids, I was having enough trouble keeping my own emotions afloat and taking care of my own four kids. If I had been raped and had to deal with a unplanned, unwanted pregnancy that I was forced to have the baby, emotionally, I think I would have fallen apart.
Margie, thank you so much for sharing your experiences. We'll get Dr. Grimes in on that in a moment. And we also have Stephen on the line in La Crosse. Stephen, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I've noticed that this show so far today has been mostly pro-abortion. And I guess I'm just calling to voice my opposite opinion that just the thought of how most people today keep trying to argue that the embryo that's inside there is not a child, I think is absolutely wrong. And I do understand that when it comes to rape and when it comes to incest and stuff like that, that's a whole different category, but it's just not really the case. Usually I see so many, you know, teens and women getting abortions just because they think they have better things to do, or their parents are forcing them to do it or something like that. And there actually is a lot of women out there and who have their own stories of how thankful they are that they didn't get the abortion when they see how beautiful.
Stephen, thanks. Almost out of time. Dr. Grimes, a brief response.
Well, let me respond first to Margie. And the question of rape is a very important one. And I think your listeners need to know that the Republican Party has had complete abolition of abortion as a plank in its platform since the 1980s. And at the most recent convention, there was no exception for rape or incest. That is cruel beyond words. Regarding Steve's point of view, we need to respect the individual woman's choice. Choice is important, and we, especially men, should not force our opinions on women.
Dr. Grimes, we'll leave it there. Thanks to Dr. David Grimes, former chief of the Abortion Surveillance Branch at the Centers for Disease Control. His new book is Every Third Woman.